Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Deanna Meyer. She's a longtime environmental activist and a member of Deep Green Resistance, and is also the founder and executive director of Prairie Protection Colorado. Meyer's work currently centers on the protection and preservation of prairie dog communities up and down Colorado's Front Range. So first off, thank you for your work, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Well, thank you.
So let's start by talking about prairie dogs. Who are they, and why are they so great, and what was their range and population prior to conquest, and what is going on now?
Yeah, well, prairie dogs, like just about everything that we're seeing that were essential and native to this continent, are being annihilated with a continuous annihilation plan that, you know, began in the 1700s and 1800s, where they really started going after them for the ranchers and to get them off of any land that they wanted to put cattle on. So they did a huge campaign with cyanide, strychnine, everything that they could to really eradicate the species from all grazing land and from the continent, really. And they're extremely resilient because they're still here. And they're in very bad condition, though, really. They have very few left. There are less than 1% of their historic numbers remain. And you'll see them living in the medians on highways. You see them in vacant lots. You see them by the airports in Denver. You see them living on the side of railroad tracks. So they basically, and then people get this crazy idea that, oh, there's prairie dogs everywhere. And really, they've just been moved out of all of their beautiful territory and home on the shortgrass prairie. And they're just trying as hard as they can to continue their existence in these really horrible situations where they just don't have much at all. And I mean, just to give you the scope, I mean, I've heard you talk about it and other people, but there were probably at least 5 billion prairie dogs in North America, and now they're down to in the millions, the lower millions. I don't know the exact number that they're using now, but it's less than 1%. And in Colorado, they continuously are killing them for development along the Front Range right now. They also poison them all on the vast grasslands in the east. But what I'm aware of and what I'm working on is up and down the Front Range where I live, and where one development after another is coming in because of this massive growth wave that we're having here in Colorado. And they just kill most of them using aluminum phosphide, which is phosphine gas. And they get gassed in their burrows, and you just see fewer and fewer and fewer of them around. And it's really heartbreaking. And they are an amazing species, and everything that we learn about them, and more people are starting to care a lot more about prairie dogs because nobody was really aware. They just have this horrible stigma, like all things that this culture hates. They all of a sudden are disease carriers, they're plague carriers, they're just dirty little rodents that serve no purpose other than destroying land, is the myths out there that a lot of people hold on to. But more and more people are starting to understand through extensive studies, thanks to Khan Shlobachkov and John Hoagland and other people who've just done an enormous amount of work, that they have like the most complex language ever studied. They're extremely social. Duh. I mean, they have language like all other species do, and we try to pretend like somehow we're so great and different. But the prairie dogs, to me, are just an amazing animal because I am around them, I see them, I can watch them, and I also know the heartbreaking story of the loss that they're experiencing. And they kind of just reflect everything that's happened to everything living and vibrant on this planet, and they're the last of them, and it's actually pretty heartbreaking.
So can you talk, what was their historic range? Did they obviously were along the Front Range of Colorado. They went as far east as far south as far north as Montana. Where right. Where were they?
They were all over the western shortgrass prairies. And they, just from what you said, I mean, they were in Mexico. They were up here in the mountains. There's all different kinds of species. There's 5 different species of prairie dogs. So up at my elevation where I am, there was a lot of Gunnison prairie dogs, and you have the white-tailed prairie dogs, the Utah prairie dogs, the black-tailed prairie dogs. And you just see that they were, wherever they would be able to survive, they did pretty well. and they weren't like lots of people. Another myth that people think of prairie dogs is that they are just these like bunnies or whatever, that they breed like you wouldn't believe, and that is not true at all. So they established these places on our short grass prairies all throughout the entire West, both north and south, and just all over an extensive amount of area. If you can imagine 5 billion animals and prairie dog colony in Texas, that was 25,000 square miles. I mean, they anywhere they could live, they would do well, but I think they did well a lot more from language and social skills and communication than ever from breeding. They actually go into the females go into estrus for about a year, and they have one litter, and they have between 2 and 8, usually between 2 and 4 babies, and at least half of those are predated. So you can imagine how long it took them to get to those large, large numbers across prairies. And a huge myth that people have about prairie dogs is that they breed like rabbits, they spread like the plague, and they carry the plague too all over, and that they're out of control. And all of that is just nonsense. I mean, they do establish territory, and they create towns and colonies. And so they'll spread out over an area to where they're supposed to and to feel comfortable in. But, you know, the myths keep carrying on like that. But they were just anywhere that they could live and have a good food and be out and on the prairie and see for long ranges. That's really important to prairie dogs, so they can see the predators. They did quite well.
Can you talk about, there are keystone species, right?
Right.
Can you talk about that concept and talk about how that applies specifically to prairie dogs?
Right. Well, I call them the coral reefs of the prairie, and there's up to just 180 vertebrates that depend on them. That's not counting all of the insects and all the plants and every other living being that depends on them for a healthy prairie community. And in order to have a healthy prairie community full of life of all these variety, hundreds of different species, the prairie dog is absolutely essential. So even black widow spiders, rattlesnakes, all kinds of different insects, the plants and everything are benefit from and are dependent upon the healthy numbers of prairie dogs out on the prairies. A couple of like glaring instances of what really depend on prairie dogs that we see are the black-footed ferret, whom really should have been extinct. They found one family and have bred that family out extensively now and are trying to repopulate from this very small gene pool back into colonies and having very little success. But they are they're 100% dependent on prairie dogs. More than 90% of their diet depends on them. They depend on their colonies. The reason they are critically endangered is solely because prairie dogs' numbers are almost gone. And these little black-footed ferrets need about 20,000 acres of a healthy prairie dog colonies to survive in the long run. And that's why we see this huge failure, because they're not putting these prairie dogs, there just isn't that, those types of colonies are not left. I think they have very few, I think there's one in Mexico, and you had talked about that before, and there might be one more up here of a significant size where ferrets might actually be able to live in the long run if those prairie dogs continue to survive. But, the burrowing owl is another species that's threatened right now and closer should be endangered. So should the prairie dog. But they depend exclusively on prairie dog burrows for their survival and to raise their young. And as you see the prairie dog decline, you see them decline, and fewer burrowing owls are spotted each year.
And so do you know, and if you don't know about this, you won't talk about it, but I've read somewhere that the American Indians said that the prairie dogs would bring rain, and it ends up that recently science has confirmed that they were correct about this in the first place. Have you heard about that?
Yeah. So I guess the Hopi saying was, if you kill all the prairie dogs, there'll be no more rain. And basically that was just kind of a known statement that people had heard over and over. And I know that Harold Booner looked into that a lot, and he found out that you can imagine these huge colonies of prairie dogs where they had this massive, extensive burrow system, which played huge roles for the ecology, well, I don't like the word ecology anymore, but for the community of life out on the prairies. And they had these huge networks of these aeration and the holes in the prairie over, just imagine that 25,000 square mile one, and the water levels would rise and fall with the moon, like tides, and also when the, and it would come closer up to the surface and everything else, and it would be much like the rainforest in terms of creating condensation. The holes also help the water rise to the surface much more easily than it would if you don't have any aeration holes throughout the soil. So they did find and have said that, you know, of course, it's true that the prairie dogs did create a lot more condensation out on the prairies, similar to rainforest.
So let's just, before we go on to your work, let's talk about, just name a couple other species who, name one common species and one surprising species, if you can, who are dependent upon or who are significantly helped by prairie dogs. Like coyotes would be an example. Coyotes eat prairie dogs. But so then talk about one that's common and one that people might not know about, if you can just think of any off the top of your head.
Yeah, well, I mean, one that would be common would be all of the raptors and the Phrygianus hawks and eagles. In fact, eagles shift from summer to winter to, in the winter, they come to prairie dog colonies when the rivers freeze up, and then they go back to the rivers. And now, so sad to think about, the rivers hardly have any fish anymore now. But let's say we had a healthy land base now, you would see a lot more of that. But they do, in the winters, you'll see much more of the eagles coming to the colonies for the prairie dogs. I mean, one thing that was shocking to me was, like, black widow spiders and the rattlesnakes and everything totally depend on them for their burrows and for safety and shelter in there. Like you said, I mean, foxes, of course, the coyotes, all kinds of different raptors. Lots of people complain about coyotes here. It's so funny. They're killing off all these prairie dog colonies surrounding these neighborhoods, and then they start complaining and killing all the coyotes, too, because the coyotes start coming into their yards looking for food because all their food is gone. A surprising one. I think anything you can imagine that would eat, they call them the candy bars of the prairies. I've heard them being called that too by wildlife people who are biologists who have said, yeah, they're pretty much candy bars of the prairie. So anything living out there and eating off them, plant species absolutely need them because they dig up different minerals that are locked down in the soil, and they allow them to come to the surface. So certain plants do much better with prairie dogs, and you'll see horses and ungulates, buffalo totally. That's they're the bookends, I call them, of the prairie, the buffalo and the prairie dogs, because the grasses that the prairie dogs do, because of their churning and everything, the grasses are much more nutritious and sweet. So the buffalo always prefer when they have the chance to eat in prairie dog colonies. So there's just a huge antelope. There's just all kinds of animals who depend on those prairie dogs for the amazing service they do to the land and to the native grasses and everything. I mean, a big problem now in Colorado too, and you see it in all these land officials harp on it all the time and use it as a reason to kill, is that prairie dogs are, they're going back they're on the land, and you'll see these denuded landscapes of bindweed, mostly, or invasive weeds, and that's what the prairie dogs have been forced to live with because ranchers have come in and crops have come in and completely destroyed the native plants. So then they blame it on the prairie dogs because the prairie dogs come in and eat what they can. They're super resourceful. Then you'll see more of a bare land or weeds taking over there, but really it's not the prairie dogs, it's the damage that's already been done to the soil, and which has totally made it impossible for the healthy native plants to survive in those areas. And that's almost everywhere in Colorado now, just about, that has been tilled, which is, you know, almost all the land that I have seen.
So before we talk about your work, I want to go back to this candy bars notion for a second. And we, I mean, of course, the prairie dogs are wonderful beings for themselves and not merely as food for others. And you and I both know
right.
that. But having said that, some of the pictures that you've sent me of prairie dogs that you've taken, you've taken pictures, are the prairie dogs, some of them can be pretty fat little creatures, and that suggests a nice little meal for a nice big meal, nice, I'm meaning this in a value positive sense, actually, a nice chubby meal for someone who wants to get it. There's a lot of nice fat for them to eat.
Right. Yeah. And it was funny because I don't know very much about this, but I was talking with Stephanie C. From the Buffalo Fields campaign, and she had just met somebody from a local indigenous tribe in that area, and she was talking with her about prairie dogs. And she had said, and that was the first time I heard that too, because you just don't hear it very often, but she said, our people love the prairie dog. We ate more prairie dog than we did bison. That was more part of our diet than it was with the buffalo. And she just said she thought that was really interesting, and I did too. It makes sense. It makes sense because the whole thing is, when you have a huge, healthy population of these prairie dogs out on the prairie, they are part of the land and part of the health of everybody else connected to that land, just like salmon or whatever. So, of course, they feed everyone when everything's healthy and in balance.
So before we get to your methods of protecting colonies and some specific actions that you're working on, can you briefly also just tell the story of how you started working on prairie dogs? Because as I've said to many people many times, you are one of my heroes for getting off your butt and actually seeing a problem and doing something about it. And so can you tell that story? Because I find it so inspiring. And I want every damn person listening to this to A, listen to it, and then B, do the equivalent wherever they live.
Right, yeah. Well, I mean, it first started with reading your work and with understanding the problem, which I always knew there was a huge problem, and your writing connected all those dots for me and gave me this huge urge to do something, because I knew that I wasn't crazy anymore and that there's a huge issue out there and that we need to get off our butts and do something. And then I've just started paying attention to the prairie dogs. You talk a lot about the prairie dogs, you always have in your books, which made me really start thinking a lot more about them, who they are, what they're doing. I live right here in Colorado. I've always loved prairie dogs. I've always thought they're so cute, that kind of thing. But then when I started reading, connecting the dots, understanding who they really were, reading your work and recognizing your love for them as well, then really starting to pay attention, I started noticing how few of them were left as compared to how many of them were around when I was young. And then I saw this colony I've always paid attention to, started watching this colony, would pull over all the time with my son, just watch them. And one day we drove by this colony off of Daniels Park Road where I live, and it was gone. They had killed everybody there, or had killed most of all the population, and I was just devastated. And then I started thinking about this, the last big colony that I had been familiar with since I was young. And I started really worrying, like, I better do something now, because every colony, and this is true, every colony we see in Colorado right now is in danger on the Front Range for sure. Any plot of land that isn't open space and protected, and even then, they're getting killed all the time. So I went and just started researching what's going on in this colony, and then I found out that they were going to build the nation's biggest mall on top of this huge 166 acres of prairie dogs, which isn't huge if we think about what's supposed to be on the land, but for what is left now, it was one of the biggest on that front range as well. So biggest mall on top of one of the biggest remaining prairie dog colonies. There were thousands, probably 8,000 to 10,000 prairie dogs there. And so then I just didn't know what to do, started wringing my hands. Then you helped and got me connected with some other activists. And we just started, and I didn't know how to start a campaign, but I was kind of directed on how to do it. And I just started writing petitions to get signatures so that we could get an email list. I started writing emails every single day to everybody on that list. I gathered a big core group of people who would get on phone calls every night and talk about what we were going to do to save them. We started going to every single city council meeting and really working on that angle. And then when they approved the final stage of what they needed to in the mall, so we pulled a referendum on there, got out on the streets, got all the signatures. They ended up killing most of the colony, but there were hundreds of survivors, and we did end up in the at the end, saving all the remaining survivors, of which there were several hundred. So we ended up doing not what I would have wanted to have done, which would have been to save everybody or to stop them all, is what I would have wanted to do. But we, in that, we did a lot more than just save the several hundred that are still sitting up here where I live. But we also just really ignited a huge wave of people caring and understanding and learning a lot more about the prairie dogs, and we made a lot of press out of it too. So all of that was good. It seemed to bring a lot more awareness to a lot of people in Colorado who didn't necessarily hate prairie dogs. People who hate them, you're not going to really change their mind, but they also didn't care one way or another, and they ended up caring a lot and understanding way more about what the prairie dog or who the prairie dog is.
And I want to emphasize, or would like you to emphasize, if it's true, that you didn't really know what you were doing at first, and you didn't let your ignorance or naivete or just lack of experience or whatever we want to call it stop you. And also, if you could mention one more thing before we do this, which is one of the actions that you did, or one of the things you did, was to or your group did, was to get students involved, get children involved to go speak at the state legislature or the Denver City Council or something. What was that?
Yeah. Well, they were trying in Denver, or in Colorado, they already have a Senate bill that they passed in 1999. It's called Senate Bill 9911. And what it does is it restricts, and I'm dealing with that right now in one of our campaigns, it restricts any prairie dog relocation over county lines unless you get the approval of all the commissioners of the county that you move the prairie dog into. And what that has done for people who would like to save prairie dog colonies is basically made it impossible, because it is very rare, I think it's maybe happened once since 1999, that commissioners will approve of a prairie dog move into their county, because they all hate them. They don't want prairie dogs in their county. So, and that bill was passed as really a slap in the face to somebody who was quite, who had made quite a lot of accomplishments in saving prairie dogs and had actually put together a land trust, and her goal was to put as many prairie dogs as she could onto that piece of land, and they stopped it through that law. So this law the beginning of 2016, they were trying to pass a bill that would do the same thing for within-county relocations, which would mean if I wanted to move those prairie dogs at the Castle Rock Mall, and it's already impossible to do, it's already extremely difficult to do a relocation with all the already horrible obstacles that we have to overcome. So they were going to add just another obstacle, which would mean the commissioners would have to approve of any move of any prairie dog to any place within the county as well. So we got involved with a school, Denver Expeditionary School, and they all got really excited and wanted to help save the prairie dogs. So we got a huge class to go to that hearing. And it was kind of sad because they knew we were all coming, and on purpose they made sure that this oil bill was going to go first, which means that the kids did sit there for about an hour and a half, but that went on for 4 hours. So then the kids came back, the ones who were talking, as soon as they just were on hold, they weren't going to go away. And there was a panel of three girls that did a really awesome speech to all of the Senate hearing, to the committee that was listening to it. And they did end up throwing away that bill.
So just to be clear,
they killed the bill.
Just to be clear, the state legislature knew that children were going to be involved, and so they intentionally put other things in its place so that in an attempt to discourage these children from sticking around and participating in this civic process. Is this what you're implying?
Yeah.
That's great.
And the whole thing was a nightmare because they postponed it two times. They tried, I do believe in retrospect, looking back, that those kids had a huge, huge impact on that bill being killed. It was in they call it the Kill Bill Committee, But we had, you know, when you start lobbying and stuff, you get the insights. And there was one person who was going to vote as a favor to these ranchers for the bill, and the pressure that we put on that person, on her, it was Sue Ryder, the pressure we put on her with those kids turned her vote around. That's and great. She just couldn't do it anymore because of the press. The kids got in. The press loves kids, so we got a great article in the Westword. We got a lot of press. They got a lot of press. And they kept trying to postpone the hearing, which is extremely frustrating because the one time they postponed it 1 hour before the hearing. And why did they postpone it? Because the person who wrote the bill, Kevin Priola, and I'm not saying this is intentional or not, but he went to go see the Super Bowl, and his plane got delayed, so they canceled the hearing an hour before. The kids were devastated. They were all dressed up. They were all ready. They were all had their speeches. Then they postponed it again about 3 days before, and then finally they did it, and then they pulled that trick where they the whole room was full of the class because they brought 75 kids in there. So 75 kids and they're third graders, and they sat in there for an hour and a half, very quiet, and listening to this oil bill being presented, which was important too. But they I'm sure were very bored, but they were quiet the whole time and sat there waiting. And when you know. Like I told the teacher, this is going to take hours, and it did. But they came back. But yes, it was, and I believe very much it was intentional.
Well, civic participation is good unless it's going against industrial capitalism.
Right.
So let's talk about the focus of your work and some of the projects you're working on right now.
So what we've been doing in the past couple years is just mounting one campaign after another. So we advertise. We do a lot of our work through our Facebook page, and that's just Prairie Protection Colorado. And we talk about colony. People come to me and say, "Oh my gosh, I'm so concerned about this colony. Can you help?" And then we kind of look at the colony, at what's happening, as we figure out if we have any kind of leverage, and if there's something we can do about the colony. And then we just go in and kind of do what we did with the Castle Rock Prairie Dogs, and we. Or the mall prairie dogs, and we just do several different techniques at once. The biggest thing we do is apply as much public pressure as possible on the local governments so that we create really a nightmare for them if they were to decide to kill the prairie dogs, a public relations nightmare.
For example, wasn't Naropa Institute, which presents itself as all eco-groovy and everything else, weren't they going to kill some prairie dogs?
Yeah. Naropa filed for a kill permit in Boulder in Boulder City. Before you kill prairie dogs, you have to file for a permit to kill them, which was that law came into place with activists in the 90s. And then they advertised the kill permit and tried to find a place to put the prairie dogs before they give them the permit. So they allow for a 60-day public notice period where people can try to find the land, and after that happens, they kill them. So that's what Naropa was trying to do, was open up that time period so that if nobody came up with land, they were going to kill. And of course, nobody ever comes up with land. So we of course noticed that right away. And here, this is a Buddhist inspired university, and they are planning on killing prairie dogs. And they received so much opposition from just making it really public what was going on, from protest, calling the Dalai Lama, from getting as many people involved in the situation and writing about it as we could, and they ended up pulling the permit. And the prairie dogs are still there at the Nalanda campus today.
And I just, before we go on more, I just want to emphasize that prairie dogs, I mean, like you said, they live in medians. Prairie dogs don't hurt things. I remember growing up, I don't know if this is going to mean anything to most people, but when you drive into Boulder, the Boulder-Denver Turnpike sort of veers to the right, and then you have the university off to your left, and there's a big parking lot there. And when I was growing up, that parking lot was not there, and instead it was a huge prairie dog colony. And I don't know when that got wiped out, probably in the 70s. I think it got wiped out and turned into a gravel parking lot in the 70s. But they don't, unless you're going to build a building, I mean, they coexist. You couldn't ask for a more forgiving creature. So I'm sorry, I've interrupted you several times. Can you talk more about some current projects you're working on?
Well, currently we're working on Longmont, a prairie dog colony called the Great Western Flex Prairie Dogs. And they're basically, the interesting thing about Longmont is they have a code in place for a city code, a municipal code, that states that a developer shall relocate the prairie dogs. And then at the end it goes on and says, shall relocate a few times. And then at the end it says the only way that they can kill the prairie dogs is after a good faith effort to relocate. So we started looking at this colony, and it was interesting because the city was prioritizing and fast-tracking this development because there's another group in Longmont right now that they're evicting from their land for this St. Vrain flood project. And it's a big warehouse. It's called Creative Learning Systems. And Creative Learning Systems said, well, if we don't have any place to go and move into by February, then we're going to have to leave Longmont, which fine, you know. But so the city picked this place and said, well, this is with the land developers there. We're more than willing to construct warehouse right on top of this prairie dog colony. So they were also a month late giving public notice about this because they say they were behind on their website. So as soon as we found out, which is as soon as they posted it, we got in contact with them and found out about the fast tracking and everything. And then we contacted the developers. They refused to get back to us. We started going to city council meetings. They forced the developers to hold a meeting with us. The owner of the land was hostile. He even tried to jump over the table at me as he was yelling and spitting at me and threatening me that if I postpone his development, he'll do something, you know, and very uncomfortable meeting. And then after that, because they were required to, they came back to us and said, look, we'll let you, because we were telling them, if you're going to fast track this, let's passively move them out of the way. And then we can remove all of the colony because we're confident we can find a place for them. And we're working currently with Rocky Flats to open that land because we have a lead. And they, you know, they said, oh, yeah, right. They'd never open up their land and whatever. And we talked to them. And maybe in 3 years they might open land, but not today. And we kept pressing them. And they said, okay, look, if you want the passive relocation and then the final relocation, what we want is for you to pay for it all. So they said, so if you go ahead and put $25,000 into the savings account within this week, and then you get Colorado Parks and Wildlife to put their stamp of approval on it within a week, and then you agree to pay the additional $40,000 or $50,000 it's going to cost to move them, and you deposit that money within a few weeks, then we'll give you the thumbs up.
So wait a second. They're saying that they want to destroy this prairie dog village, put right. something on its place, and yep. it is not, even though the law says that they shall relocate, mm-hmm. they are not, they're trying to force you to pay for it.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
So that we all, of course, laughed at. And then and we brought it up with the city council, and we pushed, and they were, the whole city was and still is extremely non-responsive. They don't return our supporters have sent hundreds of emails, and we have a petition with, has over 50,000 signatures now, and we have, you know, we've got tons of press on it. I mean, we've had probably about 10 articles now.
50,000 signatures over something in Longmont?
Yeah.
I mean, Longmont, yeah. I mean, let people who live in New York State know, Longmont's a town of what, 15,000, 25,000?
Well, yeah, but the 50,000 signatures are from everywhere.
No, I
There's
understand
like three...
that, but this, oh, yeah, is still, yeah. this is yeah. still for a fairly small community.
Right, it is. Longmont is part of Boulder County, and it's probably one of the most non-conservative areas in Boulder. The city still kind of just, they won't respond to us, so we went up and we thought, you know what, we're going to have to get this relocation receiving site because the only way somebody could say, look, We cannot move these prairie dogs because there's nowhere for them to go. And that is the excuse. This code has been in place for over 10 years. Not once have they moved a prairie dog colony. Not once. They've killed hundreds, but not once have they followed this code. And their excuse is always, oh, yeah, we left nothing. No, there's no place for them. So this time we're like, okay, well, let's get that place underway, you know. So we talked with the land manager of Rocky Flats, and he had been working with us from the start, and because we had thrown this idea at him, and I almost fell off of my chair or whatever, because I said, how about let's move some prairie dogs out there to Rocky Flats, because they don't have very many prairie dogs. And he said, yeah, I think I could do that. And I couldn't. I still was in disbelief till even now that he was so supportive. And then he worked, and he changed the NEPA laws, and he did a NEPA so that he could show that he did a bunch of legwork, got it all ready, said it's open. He sent the letter to the city and to me that said, yes, receiving site Rocky Flats is open for these prairie dogs. And then the city says, oh, no. And so then they told, because nobody wants to save these prairie dogs. And so then they told the land people about it, and now we're in the process of just kind of waiting, because then the land people said, the landowners, the developers, said, oh, gosh, and the city are like, oh, gosh, there's only, we can't, the only way we can get out of this is if Colorado Parks and Wildlife doesn't give the permit or if the commissioners don't okay it, which also I don't know if they'd be able to get away with that either because Rocky Flats is federal land. So it's a whole other, like, legal issue and question. But David Lucas, the manager of Rocky Flats, is looking into that and seeing what's going to happen with these commissioners. But we have to get their approval because it's cross-county line. And I don't see why they would say no because the land is so far from any of theirs. It's on a federal refuge. And it seems like even Rocky Flats and the managers there are pretty confident they'll approve it, but I don't know yet. And so we're kind of waiting on that. And then we'll see what happens from there. They're not going to want to hire us. They'd rather die than hire somebody who could relocate prairie dogs well and ensure a survival rate. They're going to try to hire their people who have never even done any relocations before, and they're extremely complicated. And, of course, the land manager at Rocky Flats isn't going to allow that. So it's an interesting, we still have a long way to go on this colony, and I have no idea what's going to happen. Just like last week, and I shared that with you, but we had another group of environmental activists. They're called the Rocky Mountain Peace and Justice Center, and they have been fighting Rocky Flats for a long time, and recently, and I knew this was going to crop up, but recently they had filed a lawsuit against Rocky Flats because Rocky Flats wants to open up the refuge in 2018 for visitors. And they have filed a lawsuit because Rocky Flats is where they created and produced a lot of plutonium back in the Cold War, and they were negligent about what they did, and it's a Superfund site. So they have the whole area where they created this plutonium. It consists of about 1,300 acres, sealed off, poured with concrete, all of that, and they've contained, or say they've contained, the nuclear waste. This group says, no, they haven't. It's going to kill everybody probably on the planet. And they think that, so then they got involved, and where we're putting these prairie dogs is 1 mile, it's beautiful actually out there on Rocky Flats. And just like Chernobyl or anything that we learn about where you see where there has not been human impact for a long time, they really rebound and they come back. And this place in Rocky Flats is so amazing because it's one of the only places up and down the Front Range that has never been tilled. Nobody's ever taken a plow to this land. So when you walk out there, you see all these native plants that you see nowhere else. I've never seen, it has some of the most diverse native plants. And when I was talking to the land manager too, he said, that's why this place is so wonderful for introducing back these native species, because they will not harm these plants. They will only benefit them. They won't be in this barren wasteland of bindweed. And this will be like the true prairie that they can live in. And right next to where we're relocating them is another colony that's been doing well for decades. It's living right there. Been there forever. But this environmental group went out and did a huge press release that said, prairie dogs being moved on to Rocky Flats will unleash plutonium and endanger everybody in Boulder. And all of the news channels went after it. They just love that sensationalist stuff. So last week there was about 5 different news shows on this issue, and so they just opened up another. It's so hard to move. I always say to myself, it's so, and we all know that as environmentalists, that it should never be this hard to do the right thing. And it is so hard to move these prairie dogs. It's so hard to save them. And the miracles that happen with this land manager and everything to actually open up this refuge and look at the land and get all excited about it. And then out of all people to come in and just throw another fire, start another huge fire that now we're going to have to focus on putting out is quite devastating and frustrating.
Yeah.
So
oftentimes peace and social justice activists are not always friends of the earth.
Right.
They're quite often certainly not ecocentric quite often.
No.
So we have like 7 or 8 minutes left, and a question I want to ask you is, I mean, 2 questions. One of them is obviously the short-term goal is to save as many prairie dogs as you can, but the longer-term goal is for these colonies not to be forcibly relocated in the first place.
Right.
And the other is in the meantime, while you are relocating, is there, if we didn't have to worry about politics, is there still good habitat apart from at Rocky Flats where they could be relocated? If all we were doing was a technical, once again, I'm not accepting the relocation as the primary option, as you aren't either. Primary option is to shut down this whole culture so that there are no more malls built or warehouses. But in the meantime, where we're living in the real world, and you're trying to save prairie dogs, if you didn't have to worry about politics, would it be like when, oh shoot, I can't remember her name right now. The wonderful woman who relocates the beavers.
Right.
What's her name?
Right, her name's sticking in my, I'm forgetting her name as well.
Well, she's wonderful in any case. And she told me that there is a lot of habitat. There is more habitat than there are beavers right now. And if you didn't have to worry about politics, is there plenty of habitat where prairie dogs could be relocated if necessary?
Definitely. So, I mean, just like we've talked about, I mean, Rocky Flats is just kind of prime because they actually have the native grasses in place. But I totally, these prairie dogs, as you've said, well, another huge thing that impacts prairie dogs is the plague, and that runs through and kills them all in a matter of 72 hours. They'll all die. And we see that happening. We see outbreaks of that happening all the time, and the plague was brought by, da-da-da, Europeans, you know, who brought them over, the rats and the rats. And they have no susceptibility to this. They don't carry the plague, never have fleas carry plague. Prairie dogs die from the plague. So that's another huge impact on them. And you'll see all these, our goal with Prairie Protection Colorado by doing these campaigns is not to move prairie dogs at all. Like you said, I wish that we never had to relocate any prairie dogs, but I also would much prefer to relocate them than see them gassed to death. But the main goal is to be able to, in every single county, and we have a grassland species plan for Colorado that lines this out perfectly and says that this should be happening, but nobody follows it, is that there should be a significant amount of open space land set aside for maintaining and securing, preserving prairie dog colonies and short grass prairies. And if they would spend as much money as they spend on poisoning prairie dogs on all of these open spaces in Colorado that have prairie dogs existing, and put that into native seeds and into land restoration, it would totally work. And our goal in these campaigns is that. So we did the Naropa, but then we did the Armory campaign. We did the Broomfield campaign. Now we're doing the Longmont campaign, the Castle Rock campaign, all those. And in both the Broomfield and the Armory campaign, we forced Boulder to open up land for these prairie dogs, which is the goal, and we forced Broomfield to open up land for those prairie dogs. So, and the open space preserved land where they're supposed to, with quotations, be protected and be preserved, and you know, that we want to see these healthy colonies feeding the other wildlife and being there for themselves. So, I mean, in highlighting all these campaigns, we're trying to draw enough grassroots support from people in Colorado to really get more and more people caring about the poisoning, which most people care about that, and about the species itself, the declining baseline of prairies themselves and the prairie dogs, and encouraging everybody to get behind the harder work of changing legislation and of holding the counties accountable to preserving open space land for wildlife. And we're kind of chipping away at it, and that's the point of our campaigns. And people seem to really like the pictures of the prairie dogs, the stories of the prairie dogs, and then they kind of get hooked in that way and they start caring more and more. So the more we can build up grassroots support from people throughout Colorado and throughout everywhere, throughout the United States, for this species through the education and the work that we're doing in working on these relocations and preserving and highlighting what these people are doing to these communities of life, the better chance we're going to have of actually making big changes where we can preserve these species. Because right now they're in so much trouble genetically. And, you know, I mean, they're just being wiped out everywhere. Prairie dogs, because of their huge population, have always really been, have a huge system of biological integrity to where they really spread out and go from colony to colony, and they've always had this great diversity in their genes, and that's just about gone. So that's, you see the plague wipe out 90% of them over thousands of acres, which happens a lot on these larger colonies, and that whole genetic pool is gone forever. And then you have all these really diverse genetic pools that are just shoved into these little corners up and down the Front Range on these lots, these urban lots that are going to turn into developments, and then they wipe out each one of those. And it's just, if it continues, and we're about at the end of the line at less than 1%, there's going to be no more prairie dogs. They're resilient, but nothing's resilient enough to withstand the horrors of this culture.
So we have like 2 minutes left. I've got two questions real fast. The first one is, you know, if they are a keystone species, not if they are, but since they are a keystone species, there are lots of results of when they reintroduced wolves or when wolves came back to Yellowstone that it helped all sorts of creatures. So couldn't prairie dogs be used not only for themselves, but couldn't they be used as land restorers to put prairie dogs into a place that has been harmed and then watch it over decades or over even years that fast as it rebuilds through the prairie dogs doing the work? And then the second question is going to be, how can people help you in Colorado? And also, how can they do this with whatever issues are important to them where they live? And I'm sorry it's so fast, but we got like 2 minutes for both those questions.
Well, definitely what you said about the healing of the land, that's what, even at Rocky Flats, the point that I'm really pulling out is that all land's destroyed. Rocky Flats certainly has its own set of issues, but the only thing that's going to heal the land are the species of the prairies, of the prairie community itself. And what our job is really is to get everybody back out there, get the bison out there, the buffalo, the prairie dogs, all the, you know, native plants that we can help, you know, with that, and get everybody out there and step back, because they know way better what to do with the prairies than we do. That's their home. They're the healers, the mycelium, bacteria, fungus, lichen moss, all that stuff. If we lay it off of it and quit trampling all over it and quit trying to control everything, it will eventually heal itself. And that's so important. And as far as people helping in Colorado, you can get involved. We're working on our website. It's coming along here and there. It's prairieprotectioncolorado.org. And then you can get onto Facebook on our Prairie Protection Colorado page, message us there, ask how to get involved. We definitely have a lot of work and places and things that people can do, and anybody outside of Colorado can get involved on that page. And in terms of doing your own work and for whoever it is you love in your area, because, of course, it's under attack, I'd say just don't ever step back and wring your hands like I almost did with the prairie dogs and, oh, there's nothing to do, everything's so terrible. Just step forward and do whatever it takes to draw any kind of attention to it. And if anybody needs help just learning about campaigns and how to build those up, I'm more than happy to share what we do to make it happen.
Well, thank you so much. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Deanna Meyer. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.